the flow of the ideas was as follows. Since we started off in the first section of this well-known book or subsection of the Rambam, the first section dealt with how to correct mistakes that a person has made in the past. We dealt with that in detail. We saw that the mistakes a person can make in his own being, that means things a person could do that are negative, that affect only himself. Actually, nothing affects only you, because the whole cosmic structure is related to every detail of what you do. So actually you cause intense damage to the world, the worlds, as they say in the mystical writings. Not only do you cause damage to the worlds, actually you cause damage to every other Jew and every other human being, because the way the whole system is set up is that everything's interdependent. In all the mystical writings it says that it's just like the human body. If one cell malfunctions to a sufficient degree, then the whole body can be very sick. There's nothing that's disconnected from anything else. But nevertheless, there are areas that are more in the ambit of one's own being, responsibility, and then there are those that are more connected to one's dealings with other people. You're going to make me nervous standing all night. Sit down, move forward. Are we still too early? You can move those machitzes. So. The ladies at the back, it's frum enough if you sit here with the ladies. You don't have to sit behind the machitza as well. Okay, again. The second area is things that a person has done that affect directly other people. Both those categories can be corrected. If a person made mistakes in either of those areas, almost without exception, and according to the mystical writings, without exception, and we'll see that depth later, a person can correct things that they did wrong. You have to know how to go about it. And no one said it's easy. You have to eradicate a consciousness that you built up by doing what you did wrong. The mitzvah of tshuva, as we explained many times, is not just to mouth some words that you feel sorry for what you did. The whole point of the tshuva is that you have to feel that way. You have to really understand what it was that you did, and you have to genuinely eradicate it from your consciousness to the point that you couldn't do that thing again. If you do that, then you don't have that thing within you, which is what it means that you've corrected that idea. We're not going to go through the technicalities. That's what we saw before. Then the Rambam explained to us, the first parak he discussed more the concept of what it means to affect one's own spiritual balance and how one can correct it. Then he went on to dealings with other people and how if you want to correct something that you did wrong to someone else, then you have to, first of all, make up to them what it was that you did wrong. If you owe them something, you have to give it back. Then you have to appease them, you have to have their forgiveness. It's not good enough just making up to them what you caused them to lack. You have to actually get them consciously to forgive you. We discussed how you go about that. There are very fascinating mystical areas. What happens if the person's not alive anymore? The Rambam had a whole mystical thing that you can do. The person's not alive and you did something wrong to them. If you weren't here, you could speak to me about that privately sometime after midnight. It's a very, not such an easy thing. You have to go to the place where the person's buried. Yeah. We saw that. Now, in the third section, the flow is that the Rambam now tells us that this balance of things that you did that were negative or damaging, and things that you generated that were positive, and every time you did a mitzvah and you worked against the resistance of your own being, a mitzvah is not just a technical act. It's something where you generate a motivation that you didn't have before. That means you create something in your own personality that wasn't there before. A mitzvah is a homework exercise. It's an exercise in self-development. It's not just a technical thing that you do without being conscious of what you're doing. When you do that, you generate a certain amount of positivity, and you end up in a situation, you end up all the time, in a situation of balance. You have certain debits in the personality, certain areas that are weak, certain parts of the spiritual body, let's say, which aren't healthy, which either haven't been developed, they withered, or they sick, you've actually damaged them, and certain parts of the body that you may have developed very well. Right? And the object is to be a well-rounded, healthy individual. That balance, said the Rambam, and of course don't forget that adding into that calculation are the two things we mentioned before. The negative things that you corrected, those are wiped out entirely if you corrected them properly. In fact, it's a mitzvah to do that, so you actually end up with a credit. As we pointed out many times, you could end up more positive from things that you did that were bad from having corrected them. Of course, you can't do that deliberately, as we pointed out. That's the one area. The other area is that in this balance is all those factors that you don't have any, that we can't judge accurately how difficult it was for you to do that thing, what the negative circumstances were that you were born into, all the things that you couldn't help in that situation, the lack of education you had in these matters. Only Hashem can judge how that balance goes, but nevertheless it is stacked up for you. And he explained to us that you have to regard yourself as if you're exactly poised in the middle, and one act on either side could swing the balance. And he went into, we tried to explain from a more mystical point of view what it means that everyone's poised in the middle. And that was where he left us. The next point we saw, what we left last time, was the fact that just as a person can undo the past in the bad sense, that means if someone did something bad in the past, you could undo that. So here the Rambam told us that if you did something good in the past and regret it, then you'd undo that good thing. Right? Because the spiritual world always functions on balance. We try to look at that idea. So let's see the next point. Okay, the Rambam says like this. If a person regrets all the good that he did, hareze ibed es kulan, he loses everything. That means if a person would be dying, and in the last moment he would give up, right? He'd give up and he'd say at the last moment that he's sorry about everything that he did that was positive. And you might think that sounds strange, but in some of the Hasidic writings it says that there is a frightening negative voice that comes to a person in the last moment of his life, and it says to him, it challenges you to give up everything. Why? Because as we said before, this force that battles you all your life doesn't fight fair at all. Right? As we pointed out many times, it's a very, very cruel being that fights you. Right? It's a fight to the death. We've said many times, we've explained, that he hits you hardest when you're least able to deal with him. Right? Anybody who's ever been through depression knows that the biggest ordeals you have, the hardest load you're given to bear is when you're least able to cope with it. Is that right? If you've suffered, you've known that. That is because he's out to kill you. He's not playing games. If you want to achieve real spiritual life, you have to conquer real spiritual death. Which means that this force of negativity is not out to play games. He's out to kill you literally. And of course, he has everything he needs to do it because he knows you very well. He is you. He knows you inside out. He knows exactly your weak points and your weak moments. He is you. He's learned up the sugya very well, usually better than you have. He knows you backwards. So he's out to get you. And the last moment of life, when everything hangs in the balance, right, because a person is judged in the next world, a person consists of what they were at the last moment, not an average of what they did while they were alive. You have to understand this. A person looks for the rest of eternity, whatever that means, the way he looked or she looked at the last instant of life. Not an average of what you achieved during your life. It's the way you finished up. The remarkable thing. So if he can mess you up at the end, in the last second, he can destroy you completely. And he tries to do that. Try to understand this briefly. First of all, why is it that the way you look, the way you really are, is the way you are at the last second of your life, or at any moment of life, the way you are spiritually, what you've achieved, is the way you are right now. It's not an average of what you've done over the last 20, 30 years. It's how you look right now. If on average you did very well, but 2 minutes ago, you made a massive, major negative inroad into your personality, that's what you are now. If you wouldn't survive much longer, so then that's what you'd be. And conversely, if you recaptured, you regained the battle, you won the battle at the end, right, even after a total life of negativity, so then that's... Now, we have to understand that, and it's not easy, but the mystical sources try to express it something like this. Of course, one must understand, as we mentioned last week, that the average of what you achieved all goes towards making you what you are now. You don't lose anything that you did in the past. Of course, if a person built muscle, if you built spiritual muscle, you worked and worked and worked. So of course all that potential is there. But you could cut it off in 1 second. The both factors apply. But the way you look is the way you are right now. Not what you're going to do, even though Hashem knows, and not what you did in the past. Try and understand. The way the mystics describe it is something like this. That you are a being, that you're a mutable, you're a bundle of potential that you can work into a certain being. What you work it into, that's what it is. It doesn't have a memory. Huh? It's not like the way you make your unconsciousness now, what your motivation is right now, where are you holding spiritually, personality-wise, that's what you are and that's all you are. I'll give you an example. I once had a Rebbe who said that it's as if a person went to a clay, you know, a pottery class, you know, where they give you some clay and you have to make something out of the clay. So what happens is they give you a lump of clay and you have 1 hour in which to make something. At the end of the hour, the clay goes onto a conveyor and it goes into the kiln and it gets fired. Once the clay is fired, it's always that way. You can't reshape it after it's fired. The transition from this world to the next is that kind of a kiln. There's a firing in which the personality is frozen forever that way. There are one or two exceptions which we mentioned before. If a person leaves children behind in the world who continue positivity or friends that he inspired, there are exceptions like that. But intrinsically what you can do is fired in the fire of the transition from this world to the next, which is a fiery experience. It's difficult for everyone. And except in the Messianic age, those who die after the Mashiach's come, it says, will be a certain kind of a kiss. But apart from that, generally speaking, it's a difficult experience. And in that transition, you get fired the way you are. Now, the idea is this. If you take that clay and you spend the whole hour making it beautiful, so then the beauty that will be reflected in that thing is a whole hour's work. Worth of work. Because every detail that you refined and polished will be reflected over there. And if you guard it carefully and jealously until the last moment and it moves into the fire, so then it will be exactly like that. It will never be able to change. But if in the last moment, after having spent an hour making it beautiful, as it moves in, you scrunch it into a formless mass, they're going to be fired that way. It won't bear the image of the work you put in. It's a remarkable thing. It won't show, are you with me? It won't show the work you put in for the whole hour, because you have that power to do in the last moment. Conversely, if you spend the hour wasting time and you didn't make anything out of your raw material, so as it goes into the fire, as you realize that it's going in the last minute, if you scramble to make something, so that what you made will remain. If in the last minute you could make something beautiful, it will be fire. Of course, it's very difficult. Very difficult. One shouldn't wait for the last moment to try and scramble something beautiful together, because it's very difficult. You're not in the habit of it, you don't have the tools, you're not accustomed to it. To start mitzvahs and emunah and holding in a very high level that takes a lifetime of training, to do that in the last minute is going to be very difficult. But theoretically, if a person did it, or if a person wiped off the blemishes in the last minute, it could be done. That's the way it gets fired. Now, that's frightening enough. But there are mystical sources that say the following idea. And I'm only frightening you with this, because if you're prepared, you can deal with it. If you're not, it's going to be bad enough if we're prepared. If we're not prepared, you've got a weak heart, you should leave now. There are mystical sources which say this, that there's the Gemara in Baba Metzia discusses this. It says that there are psukim in Tehillim that say that a person has to do a certain amount of work. Actually, there, it's talking about a person goes out to his work in the morning, and he goes out until evening, Adai Arev, it says, until the evening. The worker goes out in the morning, he comes back in the evening. It's all. The Gemara there learns that it's talking about the wages you have to pay, the agreement you have with your worker, if you didn't stipulate what time he starts work and what time he finishes work. That's the open meaning of the Gemara. That if it's a town where the workers leave home only after sunrise, and he lives a long way away, so then you can only claim that he should be on the job that space of time that it takes him to travel. On the other hand, in such a town, you can expect him to stay till nightfall, and he has to go home after dark. That's the balance, unless you made a special agreement with him. That's a whole interesting sugya about relations between employer and employee. But the mystical side of that Gemara, which is remarkable, because the Gemara there itself actually speaks out the deeper side. And there the Gemara says like this, that practically it means you have to work until nightfall. But mystically it means you have to work until the nightfall of your life. It means that as you go through the day of life, when the sun starts to set, you cannot start cutting back on the work you've done. You have to work until the sun goes down. Just like a worker, the employer can demand that he stays until dark and has to get home in his own time. So a person who works in the world has to work until the sun's gone down, and then only can he stop. So the mystics say, when it says Adai Arev, it means until nightfall, they say a frightening idea. The Gemara doesn't say this, but this is what they understand. When it says until nightfall, it means you have to work not just until nightfall, but into nightfall. That means until the falling of night. What does it mean? The following idea. It says this. When a person leaves the world, when the neshama transitions from this physical world into that other dimension, so then what happens is the following thing. Before the person is exposed to the revelation, to the light that they experience, and by the way, there's a lot of even non-Jewish writings, especially lately, last couple of years, have come out of people who've actually experienced this. Are you familiar with this? There's a non-Jewish woman who's written a whole study that she made of people who went through the experience of dying and being resuscitated and so forth, and they all describe remarkably similar things, exactly what the Kabbalistic wisdom describes. It's a very, very remarkable thing. Maybe we'll talk about that some other time. But they experience certain transitions, certain things, and they experience certain experiences. The Gemara talks about them also. But the remarkable thing is this, that they, before, and that's another story, what a person does experience. The Ramchal says that when a person leaves this world, they don't experience the final light of the revelation. That will only come after the messianic phase. Where the neshamas of people are now, people who've died and are not alive now, where are they now? So they're in a special world called Olam HaNeshamas. It's not the final revelation. He says there that it's midway between this and that. They have certain of the happiness of the exposure to the ultimate existence, and yet they're still limited in some way. They'll only go through the final stage when we all go through it together. That's another story. But nevertheless, to get to that life that a person can experience at this phase of the world's history, nevertheless, before a person is exposed to that, there's an intermediate phase. Understand? That means the person is alive. Then the neshama starts to leave them. As the neshama leaves them, the first experience that the neshama has when it's liberated from the body is not the next phase. First, it experiences an intermediate phase. What is that intermediate phase? How does it feel? Nothingness. It's an experience of transition. It doesn't have what the limitations of the body, but it doesn't have where the neshama is going. It's an intermediate zone of nothingness. And in that moment, unbelievable creature that he is, the Yetzer Hara comes to a person and it says to him, you see, I told you there's nothing here. In that instant, when the person is in transition, they say, imagine that moment for the neshama. He never did that before. It's a frightening experience. The person doesn't know what to expect. There's a judgment ahead of him. He knows that. And as he transitions and is expecting that experience, the first thing that happens is nothing. Right? Like they say, the atheists and the secularists, that, you know, just disappear. So the first thing so then the Yetzer comes to him and says, you see, there's nothing to worry about, nothing here. And if in that moment he listens and he gives up, he just lets it go, and he loses his emuna that there is some place he's going, he loses it all. Remarkable thing. Before you get too panicky, you have to know that Hashem doesn't play games with anyone. He never makes a challenge greater than you can withstand. I mean, there's no point in that. So a person will only be challenged at his level of capability to withstand the challenge. But nevertheless, it helps when a woman's in labor, which is exactly what this experience is. It's a transition from one form of existence to another. You know what it says in the Gemara? You know what it says? Huh? It's the only form of prophecy left today is when the dogs bark. Is it? Children, mad people, and dogs. That's what it says. I didn't mean to excite them too much. This is their field, you understand? I didn't put in a joke or two, you'd be terrified out of your wits, right? Okay, so that's the experience. Until nightfall means, even into the darkness, a person has to hold their mudah. That's what it is in labor, when a woman's going through labor. It's not the kind of experience you might have thought it would be. I'm not trying to put anyone off. It's a wonderful thing. But if a person would have anticipated during the pregnancy what the labor would be like, it bears no relationship to the gradation of the experience of pregnancy. It's a sudden experience that's completely different. That's what it is. Of course, someone who's prepared can handle it much better. When a person knows that this pain is what's going to give life, so then a person could handle it with happiness even. So a person who's prepared for the transition, they could handle it differently. But that's what it means. So now, what we understand is this. What comes out of all this is that, if you have any questions, prepare them, okay? Sunday night is supposed to ask questions. If something's not clear, please ask. But let's just tie together this idea. What we've established is this, that the way you are at the end is the way you finished up, not the average and not a memory of what you did before. If you go through that transition in one form, then there's no way you could ever change after that, for the one or two tangential exceptions that we said before. That's what it means. And therefore, the mitzvah of tshuva is as critical as it is, as we said. And that's how a person dare not put it off. In the seventh parakeh, the Rambam will explain the kind of tshuva a person should do before he dies. And he says you should do it all the time, because you never know how long you're going to be here. That, we'll see that later. Are there any questions on this subject that we said something? Questions on the subject? The answer to that, did you hear the question? The answer to that question is this, that if you work correctly for the lifetime, you won't lose it at the end. If you've built a skill for a lifetime, in the final match, you follow the professional tournament at the end that you've been training for, right, which is given to you only in order that you win, when it's matched up to you exactly, you won't lose it at the end. Is that, you must understand, no game's being played over here. The idea of this is to coach you through. You follow me? The only person who will lose at the end is the one who takes it on himself to fail. No ordeal, like we spoke out, I think, last week, or when did we talk about it? No ordeal last Monday night. No ordeal's ever given to a person more than he can cope with, because it wouldn't be an ordeal. And this is the final ordeal. Are you with me? If a person deliberately wants to mess it up at the end, they can do that. This is for real, not a game. That's not unfair, that's how the game goes. On the other hand, if he wants to pull it out of the fire at the last minute, he can do that too, if he's ready and ready means it, like we explained last week also. But those are the rules of the game. But they're not unfair tests that a person's going to be exposed to. Never, that's never held against you something you can't cope with. You're only... Yeah. Any other questions? Yes, please. We're going to see that right now. In two ways. First of all, right now the Rambam is going to go on to how they stacked up and how the judgment works. And later in this particular section, which is one of the reasons we chose it, he goes into reward and punishment altogether. In this world, in the next world, what it means and so forth. Just one word for now, so you've got something to work with, is that the basic concept of reward and punishment, I'm just selecting the elements that we need for now, there's much more to the subject. The basic concept of reward and punishment is that the reward is what you are. It's not something to hand out to you. You follow me? The reward is what you've become. There's no words. Unfortunately, the words are inadequate here, especially in English. It's not like a reward they pay you a wage. The reward is who you've become, because the sensitivity that you've developed is the happiness you're able to experience. The more you've trained yourself, right, to want what's correct and what's sensitive and what's right. So the more you experience that when you're exposed to it in reality, the more you've trained yourself not to want that, the greater the pain of not... A person who spent his life, I mean, the cruelest way to understand it, is that a person who spends his life in pure physicality, right, builds only muscle in the body. They're going to be tremendous pain in the next world because there is no body there. But unfortunately, the person maintains the consciousness that he built here. And he misses it terribly because he transformed, you follow, he transformed his consciousness into a physical being. Right? He didn't have the wisdom to see that the physical thing disintegrates, but the spiritual thing maybe doesn't. He's invested everything in something that for sure disintegrates. So when it disintegrates, but he's left with the consciousness, right, of wanting it. There's an amazing Gemara in Brachos that says that, I mentioned it once, maybe a year ago, I'll tell you again, that the Gemara says that there was once a man, how he got to this situation is just ancillary, I'll just mention it briefly. This man heard people speaking in the next world. Okay, he was a very great man, one of the Tanoim, if I'm not mistaken. He was on a level where he was able to hear people speaking in the next world. How did he hear that? How did he get there? It's a side issue. Very briefly, what happened was, he said an angry word to his wife the day before Rosh Hashanah, or before Yom Kippur. It was one day before. There was one night left, and the next night was Yom Kippur. And he said an angry word. And he was on a level where one angry word was a disaster. If he discovered in himself that he had a touch, a twinge of anger, it meant that the work that he'd done on himself, the refinement that he's supposed to have reached, was severely in question. So there, he had only one day to fix it up before the judgment, before Yom Kippur. So there's a whole program a person should go through. He didn't have time. So So the Gemara says, in an emergency, you should think about your death. In an emergency, you shouldn't think about that except in an emergency, because you get very depressed. If a person has done something wrong and they can't pull themselves out of it, or they are engaged in an ordeal with some negative experience, right? And they can't pull themselves out of it. So they should say Shema, they should go sit in the base where and try to learn. There's many things they should do, get involved with Torah to take your mind off it. There are many things a person should do. But one of them, if you're desperate and nothing else works, Yazkilo Yoma Mesa, you should think about your own end of your life. Because that takes the wind out of your sails. If you really understand what it means, that makes you less keen on whatever it was you were chasing, not in this physical form. So this man had only that left. He had only one day and he had to do that. But he felt he needed an experience that really would drive it home. So he went to sleep in the cemetery. Right? You know, just thinking about it, he felt wasn't enough for him. He felt he really needed to really live it. So he went, that'll fix you, by the way. That'll fix you. If you're busy, you know, if you're having trouble with a woman, let's say, like the Rambam says later, and you can't get out of it nohow, you sit in the base medrash, you say Shema, all that kind of stuff, and it doesn't work as it usually doesn't, I'm afraid to tell you. Then what you should do is, I don't suggest that you go sleep in the cemetery, because then you'd have other problems. But that isn't, anyway, this man did it. That's not our story right now. But the point is, during the night when he was there, he heard two people speaking. He heard people speaking. And one of the things that he heard was a remarkable thing. He heard two young girls. Two girls who had died young. They were buried in that place. And he heard their neshama speaking to each other. I'm giving you a digest of it. Come on. And he heard them saying, it's a remarkable thing, young girls, pass the comb, pass the makeup, pass the lipstick. That's what he heard them saying. And he suddenly realized that these are people living in a world where there is no face to put makeup on, but all they can think, if there's no hair to comb, but the only thing they have in their consciousness, you follow, is that. Imagine the pain of that. Imagine the only thing that you want, and you want it eternally, with the intensity of the next world, without any masks covering it. You want it so badly that that's what you are, and it just isn't there. You understand that? That's why we, the path of a Jew in this world, is to invest only in that world. You invest in this world only insofar as it will get you there. Keep healthy. Invest in it in a healthy, balanced way. But the main point, right, is not to invest in the thing that's going to disintegrate eventually. It's to invest in the... That's what it is. And therefore, the reward is that if, to the extent that a person's built that into their being, so that's what they are. And that's the happiness, when the whole of the next world is spiritual power. It's the happiness of understanding what existence is, what life means. Put it in other ways also. So when a person's exposed to that, that's constant ecstasy. It's in fact a spiraling ecstasy that gets more and more and more. 1 second of which, if it would be a second there, is more intense than all the happiness all humans have ever experienced from the beginning of the creation to the end of the history of the world. That's what it says. And even that's a vast understatement. But only to the extent that a person's made himself relevant to that, right? They put it very cruelly, right? In the yeshiva world they say that if the next world consists of a shir in Gemara. That's what it is. There's going to be an amazing Rebbe giving a shir in Torah. You follow me? And the Talmid HaChachamim are going to be sitting around and they're going to be absolutely thriving on this shir. They're going to be open their eyes to truths about the world that they're going to... unbelievable ecstasy. And here's this individual who never made it there. He's in the right place, but never learnt the word of Torah before. And he had pleasure out of that. He's going to sit and listen to concepts that don't mean anything to him. There's a joke they say in Yeshiva that if you want a picture of the next world, what it is a shtender and a glow tail. That's what it is. A shtender is one of these things that you see in Yeshiva. It's one of these, a lectern. You know that a person puts his Gemara on? So that with a hot cup of tea. You know, that's like an ultimate in a Rosh Yeshiva's pleasure. That's like an ultimate of physicality that he can think about. This is a cup of hot lemon tea. That and a Gemara open on a shtender. That's what it's going to be. You follow me? So a person's consciousness is very much in the physical. It's not going to... There's an exception, by the way, if you think you're not shy after learning, and that is people who support Torah learning. You can buy it. You can buy it. You either learn it, and you have to learn it anyway, even if you buy it, to some extent, at least every day and every night, but you can buy it with money. You can pay someone else to learn, support someone who learns. According to Rabbi Yashiv, it has to be that you actually support him, not just give him money in addition to what he has. According to him, I once heard an argument in two of the early Israel. One held that you actually have to support that person. That means he eats from your money so that he can only learn because you support him. You must make a contract with him. And others hold that even if you just benefit him from your possessions, even if he could survive otherwise, but he's... And you can take the lenient view in case you can't find someone that you can directly support that needs you. Then you can buy it. The reason you can buy it, I'm just mentioning it for those who feel, that their life has gone too far, maybe, to spend the rest of their life in deep Torah learning. By the way, this doesn't bother you, okay? You're not exempt. Even if you pay for it, you still have to learn every day and every night, at least something. At least some minutes every day and every night. You can't get away without that. But you can pay. The reason you can pay is not some sort of token. This is not some kind of, understand, it's not a tokenism where you put a few coins in something. It doesn't, things don't work that way in the spiritual world. The reason that you can do it is because when you pay money, that is your life. If you earn the money honestly, you didn't steal it. If you earned it honestly, you only earned it by earning it. You put your life into, you spent a day earning that. How much time did you spend? You follow me? You spent a month earning that amount of money. Or the month salary that you give this person who's learning, 3 days in the month, let's say, of your earnings went to this person. So 3 days of your life. You spent 3 days earning that money. That's why it says that tzaddikim love their money more than their bodies. Do you know that? You know that? For a spiritual system, it says that tzaddikim love their money more than their bodies. You know why? Because your money is your life. If you earned it honestly, you spent your life to earn that money. You sat in a store, right? Or you manufactured something with your hands, whatever it was that you sold. But that was that day that you spent making that thing will never come back again. You follow me? So the amount that you earn for that thing actually represents your life, literally. That's why the tzaddikim never waste a drop. Yaakov Abinu risked his life to go back over the river for a few tiny pots and pans that he left behind. Because that is your life, literally. Therefore, if you take money, you follow me, a week of the month that you spend working, and you transfer those funds to someone who's learning Torah, you gave him a segment of your life. And that life force he puts into learning instead of having to work to earn that money. So you literally 100% transfer your spiritual being to him. Not a game, it's not a token. If you think about it carefully, you'll see that's the way it goes. And therefore, a person should insure and cover both options. He should spend the rest of his life in Torah. And he should also give his money to people who learn. Yeah. Doesn't know that you can't fail. You certainly can fail. But you're not destined. All I said was this, that when Hashem gives you an ordeal, it comes with a watertight guarantee that you can succeed. Not that you will. That you can succeed if you make a tremendous effort, lifting yourself to a level beyond what you were at previously. Then you'll conquer that ordeal. Yeah, you follow me? If he would give you an ordeal that you can't possibly win at, it's not an ordeal, that's just smashing you. If he puts a load on you that you can't possibly pick up, it's not a test. You're not going to gain strength from that. You're going to be smashed down. He wouldn't do that to you. It's logical, and we have an assurance from all the mystical writings. He matches it up exactly to your level, plus some, so you have to grow, and then you can cope. If you pull out all the stops and you grow to that level, you'll cope with it. There's no guarantee that you will. You've got your own free choice. Sorry? David HaMelech made two mistakes in his whole life. It's not so bad. When we get there, you're right. So of all the ordeals that Hashem gave him twice in his life, he made a slip. That's not so bad. You follow? And he could have succeeded. In fact, in that case, you chose as a difficult example, because there it says in the Gemara that when David failed, he failed because he asked for a test. And that's one of the classic exceptions. When you take on a test that Hashem didn't give you, then there's no guarantee at all. In fact, you probably will fail. The Mephoshim say you had to fail that test. So you chose the one classic example where it's actually a test that you can't pass. And that's why we said last week on Monday, and if you were here, that a person's not allowed to choose ordeals. Because if you choose an ordeal, there's no guarantee at all that you could pass it. That's why we avoid ordeals like anything, even though it's the only way you grow in this world, but we avoid them like anything. Because believe me, enough ordeals come your way every day that are tough enough without going out and looking for them. There's no guarantee you will succeed, only guarantee that you can succeed. There's virtually a guarantee that you won't always succeed. That's a mystical concept that nobody, no matter how righteous, virtually, will ever really cope with the whole of his life without ever falling at all. Right? That's another story, why not? But that's it.
Yeah. How come David and Melech grew so great that he didn't have any ordeals? And he only made two mistakes. So great.
I don't follow your question. He grew so great because he conquered all his ordeals. In fact, in that area of sexuality, it says that he conquered his drives entirely. That's why he was tested in that area. He asked to be tested in that particular zone because it killed it completely. But he only reached that after a lifetime of intense effort. Yeah. No more questions on this subject? Yes, please. To the end. Were you here on Monday night? We discussed this in detail. You can refer you to the tape of that discussion for a detailed look at it. But yes, as long as you're in this world, and with the possible exception of that transition zone, your negative drive is with you all the time, and it grows as you grow. I'm not going to go into the whole discussion again. But the stronger you get, the more you beat him down, the stronger he becomes. Are you with me? So that you're always in even balance with him at a higher and higher level. We discussed it in great detail, very detailed subject. We spent an hour and a half on Monday night. You can... No, there's no yet in the afterlife. No. Yes, the whole definition of the next life is that you... Maybe you should make that clear. In the 10th chapter of this section, he's going to go into what we understand that to be. But I realize now that there are people here who may not know that exactly. Our concept of the next world is this. The words are very clumsy and awkward, okay? The words are hardly enough to even begin with. You follow? Because we're talking about complete abstraction. And it says that even prophetic insight never sees. No prophet could even see into that world, only into the messianic world. But into that world, nobody could ever see, not even the highest level of prophecy. So we're very much inadequate to try and express it. But the basic idea, what we can grasp, is something like this. That a person is exposed to a world where there's much to say about it, but they experience an existence where what they are and what they experience is what they made of themselves. Not the raw material you were given. That all falls away. That was just the wherewithal you were given to achieve something. What you consist of over there, it's irrelevant where you began. If you began in the gutter, with all the worst disadvantages in the world, well, those disappear entirely. You follow? What you get, if you're born in the gutter, with a major, major handicaps, physical, mental, spiritual, educational, everything, your challenge might be to get from there to there. Moshe Rabbeinu, who was born at a very high level of potential, his challenge was to get miles up. But you judged on the proportion of the elevation that you achieved relative to what you could have done. A man in the gutter who gets from there to there, 99% of his ability, it says he stands next to Moshe Rabbeinu in the next world. Because obviously you're not going to be held against him that he started off some... You follow me? It's a highly handicapped system, if you like. So what happens is you're represented there by all the net balance of what you amplified your raw material, chipped away by the damage you did to yourself, which is exactly what he's going to discuss now, and that's what you consist of. But with regard to your specific question, the concept we have is this, that the best way I can put it is like this. The Mishnah says that there are two amazing qualities that the next world has. Right? An incredible elevation and an incredible pain. What is that? The happiness of the next world is that it says that, like I said before, the briefest instant, if you can talk that way, of the next world doesn't amount to the totality of pleasure that this world could contain. But, it says, that one moment of this world outweighs all the next world. Direct contradiction. But the answer is obvious. It means this. In terms of ecstasy, and what a person is exposed to, and what a person understands, and what a person, right, is plugged into the voltage there, so the tiniest amount of the next world is infinite compared to this world. But the pain, the sadness of the next world, is that while you're here, you can change. While you're here, because you're in balance with your own negativity, your own positive drive and your own negative drive, and you're locked in the battle, so the tiniest action, the smallest action, the smallest penny that you give when you don't want to and you force yourself to, right? Any action like that, any self-discipline that you impose on yourself, anything like that, you raise yourself unbelievably in the spiritual world. Right? Whereas there, no matter how much you would love to be able to do that, you just can't do it. Because you don't have the kalim, you don't have the tools anymore. You don't have a hand to give it. So, you know, all the mitzvahs are physical. Virtually every mitzvah is done with a body. There's a handful that you can count that are done in the mind. So there, you don't have a body. You'd love to shake a lulav up there. Here, you didn't think it meant anything. But in that world, you're exposed to what it really meant. Or put on a pair of scissors. Or give something to someone who needs it. Or smile at somebody who needs a smile. But you haven't got a mouth to smile with up there. You follow? And now you really appreciate what it would have been. That's the agony of the next world. You follow me? Absolutely not. There's no Yetzer there. But there's no Yetzer Tov either. All you have is your consciousness of what you've become with no kalim. No, don't forget that the tools, the body, is where negativity comes from. It's the, you know, we, mystically, we are pitched at three levels. The head, the chest, and below the diaphragm. In the head is your spiritual being, with your common sense. In the chest level is, mystics describe, an emotional level. Below the diaphragm, you have the physical level, reproduction and digestion, not the physical drives. You're only left with the highest dimension when you get there. So there's no emotional interplay, and there's no physical factors. So they don't speak to you anymore. So all you are is what your consciousness is. So you don't have any negativity, because the only reason you have a negative drive is because your body speaks to you. If you were pure common sense in this world, you wouldn't do anything wrong. If you're pure intellect, pure logic and intellect, you never would do anything that's wrong. Because the common sense would tell you that the danger, the damage outweighs the good. The trouble is the emotional level starts drowning out, right, and makes you think krum. And then the physical level gets involved, it's even worse. I don't know which is worse, they're both terrible. Are you with me? In that world, you don't have both voices. So you have pure clarity, then you can't think. They say when the Gaon was dying, he was crying. So the Talmidim said to him, why are you crying? If anybody should be happy about where he's going, a big tzaddik like you. He said, I'm crying not because of where I'm going. I'm sad to leave a world as beautiful as this, where for a few pennies you can do a mitzvah. You can buy tzitzis. The Gaon wasn't being sentimental. What he meant was that a few pennies in this world change your spiritual status infinitely. The next world, no matter how wonderful it is, there's just nothing you can do. That's why when you go to a cemetery, you have to put your tzitzis in. When you walk into a cemetery, you tuck your tzitzis in. Because it hurts them terribly. The people who are buried there, there's a certain hovering. The neshama of the person hovers over that place in a certain way. Not our subject right now. Certain level of the neshama. And the neshama is terribly pained when it sees mitzvahs. Because now it would love to do the mitzvahs that it can't do. So we don't cause them that pain. That's not superstitious nonsense. That's a very... Yeah. Let's stick to relevant questions, you mind? We're having enough trouble... Yeah. I don't follow your question. You understand? I understand. Your question is his question is, why do you have to be reincarnated if you've reached the level that you've reached? Your question is not, it's got nothing to do with the level you reached. Your question is, why do you have to be reincarnated at all? Why do we need such a thing? Get to your level, have your reward or whatever state it is, why come back? The answer is, first of all, it's a deep and complicated area. Not everyone is reincarnated. According to many of the mystical opinions, most of us are here for the third or fourth time. People sometimes come back as not human. The long and detailed in the Arizal, there's a whole Shara Gilgulim, a whole section that deals with this subject. But just very briefly, we don't understand that a person comes back to fix up something that they did wrong in the sense of sinful. We understand that a person might come back to fix up something that was needed to be done in the world that they didn't do, even through no fault of their own. It could be that that neshama had to do certain what's called tikkunim. It's all very mystical talk. But it had to achieve certain results in the world. It had to do certain things for whatever reason. That's a difficult subject why anything has to be done here, but take it for granted for the moment. If that neshama didn't do that in the world, either because it failed to do so, or because it was taken out of the world before it could, because of other factors. Sometimes a person is taken out of the world earlier than he should be, in order to maintain the balance of other factors. Hashem makes it up to him. But he left undone a certain thing that needed to be done, that his neshama had to do and experience. So he gets another chance, not always even as a human, to do that. There's at least one Gemara that talks about a person who came back in the form of a young calf, that was about to be shechted. The Mashal says, that's what I thought. You follow? Reincarnation is another whole story. It's not that you... There are a lot of non-Jewish concepts about it that are not right at all. Okay, and they have to be carefully teased out and separated out and mostly destroyed. Yeah, any more questions on the subject? Yes, please. What about them? Your question is part of a larger question, which is why do seemingly unjust things happen in the world altogether, which is not tonight's subject, which has to be discussed. But in term, only extracting from your question what's relevant to what we said now, we have the following idea. It's a whole long discussion in its own right. But briefly, I'll just extract one or two relevant details for you. One is that when a neshama comes to this world, even if it never lives to the age of experiencing free choice, it undergoes what's called a tikkun. By being connected with the body, which is an enormous impact on the neshama, even if it's only as a fetus, even if it's never born, never mind a child, even if the fetus gets put into a body and then it's lost, so it says it will have a chance to experience the resurrection, Tchiyas HaMasim. Because once it was once connected with physicality, it could be done again. If it never was once connected with the physical, it will never be able to come down again, because you must understand that a neshama that's not put in a body is not real. It's only potential. It's not actual. It's called a bekoyach. It's like a potential to be. You have to understand what this means. It's not subdivided from Hashem's oneness, whatever that means. But when it's broken away and put into a body, it achieves an independent existence, and it could come back again. So it's a big bracha. You have to understand this. It doesn't look that way to us. It looks like a tremendous sadness to us. One of the ways we comfort people who have losses, not only children, is that we remind them that they'll meet that person again. In the Tzviyas HaMaisim, they will actually experience that person again. They'll be together with that member of their family, even if they weren't there to really know them, even if it was a fetus. They'll be together with their child again. Because it will definitely be there, especially a child. Because a child didn't have a chance to damage his spiritual essence. So once he was put together, if he didn't reach Bar Mitzvah, and in certain respects, 20. Some things happen only at age 20. Certain things that you're accountable for. But most things, in terms of divine punishment. But most things from age 13. If a child never reached that level, he never bore any responsibility for his life. Potential rates. Those neshamas haven't had a chance to come down. And so the rate of putting neshamas that give them at least the chance is being sped up. You hear that? Why does neshamas haven't had a chance to come down? Maybe because people haven't had children the way they should have. Maybe, yeah, the latest fashion is to have two dogs and a child, if you're lucky, or what people want to do. You follow me? So, therefore, it means that if a neshama is connected with a body, once it's experienced that, it's very much in the world, and therefore, it's got nothing to do with punishment. There is a concept of punishment, which is very hard to talk about, and I'll just tell you one idea. And that is, it says that if a child was less than Bar Mitzvah, then what happens is that anything that happens to that child, not only if the child, Chas v'Shalom, Lo Aleinu, dies, but even if the child, whatever happens to the child, is on the parent's account. Understand that. It's on the parent's account. If a child under Bar Mitzvah, or Bat Mitzvah, then what happens is that they connect it to the parent's being. Actually ask any mother, she can tell you, mothers actually feel that, especially till age 3. They can feel a tremendous energy being sucked from them into the child. It lessens after that. From Bar Mitzvah on, there's a severing of that relationship and a child takes their own responsibility. You follow me? Which means whatever happens to a child, a parent, it's on their account. Parents don't need to be told that. They can feel that. But spiritually, that's the way it works. There is a deep understanding when a boy becomes Bar Mitzvah, his father makes a brocha. Baruch Shep Tarani Mi Onsho Shel Zeh. Blessed is he who has exempted me from the punishments for this child. The conventional pshat, the conventional understanding of that, is that the father makes a brocha because he's no longer liable for the child's damages. In halacha, if the child breaks your window, the father has to pay. But if he's 14, he has to pay. So the father gets up on the bimah and he makes a brocha to Hashem. From now on, Baruch Hashem, that if he breaks the window, he got to pay from now, not me. But in the spiritual world, it's much deeper than that. What it means that I'm now exempt for his punishment means that up to now, if I did something wrong, it might be vested in him, might be visited upon him in some way. Whereas if he's now got to the age where I, thank God, no longer bear responsibility anymore for my negative actions, that will hurt him. You follow? Remarkable idea. There's much more to talk about, okay? But that's... ultimately, we haven't discussed the depth of your question, which is why bad things happen that we don't understand. That's another... I haven't pretended to answer that. That's another... You follow me? That's another big, big question which cannot really be answered beyond a certain point. That's another discussion, how much we can and can't say about it. Not people are trying. In the spiritual world, they're sending down the shamans. Not as possible. The right number that need to be put in the body. Your question doesn't even begin. That number, that stood at Sinai, right? First of all, that's only Jews. That's the whole discussion. But the certain number that you're talking about, that's the number I'm talking about. Those numbers have to arrive, and they haven't arrived yet. They have to be brought... Are you saying... Not necessarily, but how does that relate to the question? Whoever has to come down to the world now, be it of that 600,000, hasn't come down again. We're here for the third or fourth time, first of all. You follow? Has to be brought down. Or it means what the Ramchal calls the branches of those neshamas, the roots stood at Sinai. Certain branches have to also branch out that has to... Your question's part of a bigger question is that there have been much more than 600,000 Jews, and yet it says there were only 600,000 neshamas. So that's the real question. And the answer to that is probably along the lines that many of the Jews who've lived since then are actually just repetitions, right, of those. And in other mystical sources it says that many Jews who are alive, presumably people, I don't know about non-Jews, but Jews, are branches, split-ups, fragmentations, splinters of one single neshama that lived before. And not necessarily will all of them come back. You know where this idea comes from? The obvious source, Adam HaRishon. Adam himself was only one person. And we all splinters. Fragmentations of his neshama. It wasn't designed to be us. It was only supposed to be him, had he not done wrong what he did wrong. And in the end, it says that all those splinter neshamas are going to be put back together into just one again, at the end, just him. You follow me? So many of us, and that's why the Ramchal says that if you want to know if you will share in the resurrection, Sekhias HaMaisim, it's not so simple. Because there will only be 600,000 neshamas in that generation. But the good news is that you'll be back there as a piece of the whole that you were taken out of. To that extent, you follow me. Even though he does say that if a person lives correctly and really builds himself into a pure spiritual being as best he could, he will merit to stand there as a root, not just grafted on as a branch. So a person could lift himself to that. That's also in your free choice. Yes, please. No, it doesn't mean that at all. The question was, for those who didn't understand it, I once said, I didn't say it, I just quoted it, that every blade of grass has a purpose. I didn't actually say that. I said that every blade of grass and every grain of dust will finally, in the final world, will exist there. Nothing will disappear. Nothing was created that's like just accidental and will disappear. Every manifestation of reality will be in the final. We believe that Tchias HaMaisim doesn't only mean your neshama will stand up again. We believe it means that every aspect of reality will find its place and do exactly what it was supposed to do. But you can't do tshuva after death. What it means is this. You just need one idea and it will all be clear to you. The reason you don't need tshuva after death and aren't granted the opportunity to do tshuva after death is that you guaranteed, without tshuva, you'll get where you're supposed to be going. You don't need tshuva. You'll be forced to get where you're supposed to be going. The only thing you have free choice about is which path you want to take to get there. That's all. If you do it happily through what you're supposed to do in this world, so you'll get there the good, what they call the good way. What's called life in the mystical writings. If you don't, they'll squeeze it out of you in screams, right? But you'll be what's called Megala Kvod Shamayim. You have to be Megala Kvod Shamayim that has to come out of you. You have to reveal to the world. You have to reveal in the world. You have to bring out, it's all very mystical stuff, this. But each neshama has to bring out into the world what's called the Kvod Shamayim or the Malchus. You have to bring out into the world what you were destined, what you were put here to bring out. You were part of the machine and that piece of the machine has to function. If you didn't bring it out, it's going to be forced out of you. That there's no free choice about. So understand there are limits to free choice. Your free choice is only which way you're going to bring it out. Either voluntarily and happily, or if you leave it too late, they're going to squeeze it out of you. You follow? Through screams, literally. Are you with me? You won't be able to do tshuva there. It's too late for that. But they'll force you into, through pain, a person. We understand that punishment in the next world is not vindictive. We have no concept of eternal suffering in the next world, by the way. There's no such concept. We have no concept that in the next world you'll suffer forever and ever. But it doesn't make any sense. There's no point to a neshama suffering forever. The neshama will suffer long enough to drill into its consciousness that which it didn't get in here. You follow me? That's the only reason. It will regrow the organ that it allowed to shrivel here. It's much more painful that way than doing it here. You follow me? And that's the way it will be done. But in the end, every neshama... You just need to know a few facts. One is that if you read the explicit writings, like the Rambam, he says that there are some sins that are so bad that a person will be cut off from the next world, la'olam or la'olmei olamim, forever and ever and ever. I never heard anywhere else say three times the same, right? Forever and ever and ever. But the mystics explain very carefully that that's the bad news. The good news, the mystics explain, first of all, it only means those portions of the neshama that were connected to that dimension of negativity. But the purity of the neshama, the spark that makes you what you are at core, it can never be extinguished. That will always be there. I'm not saying it's not difficult, not painful, okay? But that will always be there. What it means forever, in Hebrew, there's no such word as forever. La'olam in Hebrew means for the world. You see, the English always messes you up. The translation always is a problem. In English you say forever, but there's no such thing in Hebrew. La'olam means for the world. It means that the neshama will have to go through that dimension of trying to regrow, to correct what is only as long as the world in this form. But when all neshamas transition into the next phase, we have to talk about what that means, then that neshama also will have its, you follow. The only thing is, there are some that are so bad, or so negative, or so deliberately perverted their sensitivity, that it will take all that time to do that. But ultimately they'll be forced into it. You follow me? That's what it means. It says in other places that every Jew, it means every human also, but at this level, has a share in the world to come. It says, chelek l'olam haba, has a share in the next world. And then the Gemara proceeds to list some who don't have a share in the next world. So the Mephoshim explained, it means everybody is there, but not everyone has a share. As my Rebbe once put it, some have to use public transportation. That's the way he put it. Others got their own, and others eat at other people's tables. You follow? Which is means you're there, but b'schus klal Yisrael. It's because you're part of the Jewish entity, which is one organic unity, so you can't be lost. You'll be there. but you won't have carved it out for yourself. In many illustrations, I'll just share you one with you, of what it means. There was the most extreme cases, that's what we call Gehenna. Gehenna means a dimension of suffering. You see, in the Christian sense, it's like a place of fire where you burn and you're tortured. There is that element in it, but the concept of it is, it's a place. Do you know what the pain is of Gehenna? Do you know what the suffering is? It's the experience of non-existence. You experience not being. Can you imagine such a thing? You experience the pain of wanting to be and not... You're there enough to be aware that you're not there. You follow? It's like... It's unbelievable time. What is it? Why? Why such a crazy thing? Because to the extent that you behave negatively, you aren't there. You follow? What you did is you killed your own being by taking advantage of other people, let's say. So you broke down that sensitivity in you, which was supposed to be building what's called chesed, which is concern for others and being able to go out towards other people. You killed that. So in the next world, that isn't there. And you're aware that it's not there. It's like you're missing a limb or a vital organ. Can you imagine? But the awareness that you're missing it regrows it. Because really what's missing is your consciousness of that thing. So when you come to regret it deeply enough, you follow me, it's perfectly logical. That's what regrows it. The Gemara says that Rabbi Baba Chana was once traveling through the desert and an Arab shepherd offered to take him and show him where Korach, remember the man who created a tremendous rebellion against Moses, against Moshe Rabbeinu in the desert, very negative individual who was swallowed by the earth alive. He wasn't just killed, he was swallowed alive by the earth. The mystical commentaries say it means regret for his creation. Man comes out of the earth. You have to understand, why was he swallowed alive by the earth? It's a beautiful thing to know. Why was he swallowed alive by the earth? Hashem couldn't think of a more bizarre punishment for a person. What's called a Misa Mishuna, he had to die that way. It's a teaching, you hear, that it's what's called a Nechama, it's called a regret for his having been created. A person comes out of the dust. To be swallowed alive into the dust means the life that came out of it goes back there. It's a regret, in spiritual terms, that he ever came out of there. But anyway, that's what happened to him. So this Arab said he would take him to show him, by the way, this is not... There's a big discussion in the Agadic writings whether they're meant to be taken literally or not. Okay, it's a big, major discussion between some of the major commentaries. This particular one, everyone agrees, is not literal. That means it's not physical. It's 100% literal, I can assure you. But it's not physical, are you with me? Certain stories that the Gemara brings that everyone agrees are meant to be understood metaphorically in the abstract. This is one of them. Don't think it's not literal. It's just not physical. So this Arab took him to a crack in the earth, and out of that crack was coming smoke. So he put his spear in. The Arab put in a spear with some wool on the end, and it came out singed black. It was fire. So he put his ear to the crack, and he heard Korach and his followers shouting over and over and over and over, Moshe emes, v'Torah also emes. Moses is true, and his Torah is true. Again and again and again and again and again. That which they denied while they were alive, that which they tried to break down while they were living, in that dimension, they are screaming the same words, you follow, the words, the correction of what they did over and over and over. What's the understanding? Why? That's all the Gemara says. Why are they doing that? So the mystical commentaries explain. It means that in that world, that all they experience is their mistake. And they're trying their best to correct, you follow? They're trying to impinge, to drive into their consciousness that which they didn't have here. So they're telling themselves over and over and over and over again, and it just doesn't go in. Because you can't change, you follow me? But ultimately it will change. Ultimately it will get in, and then a person will come. Those are some of the ideas that we have about the next one. Maybe one more question? Or two more, yeah? Please. If you're worried by the technicalities of it, okay, I assure you, even the smallest computer today will handle that problem with ease. In the divine system, I assure you, that technicality is a very minor detail. But there's depth to your question, and that is that it's not so simple. First of all, to be together again with a person has got certain limitations. There's one dimension that a person will only be alone. Only alone. It means your level of achievement, that's only yours to be carved out. However, there are some things, the happiness of which will be represented by the person being together with. Husband and wife, it says, will form a unit. Husband and wife will form some kind of bonded unit, like Adam and Chava were actually a bisexual creature. You know, Adam and Chava were one being. He was the one face. There was no back. There was no back and back side to their being. They were fused at the back. The woman's side was on one side. The man's side was a perfection of a unity that was all melted into one. So in a sense, it will be something like that. That's a big discussion. First wife, second wife, what happened in divorce, what happens if there's a wife that's destined for a man, what happens if he didn't marry that one. That's a fascinating discussion in its own right. But it's good news and bad news. But that's not a discussion right now. But what we mean is this. And then again, you have to understand that some people you won't be together with because you might be that person. That means if you were both sparks of the same root, it could be that that root comes back, but there'll be no greater happiness than that. You'll be at one with that person. You follow? Again, we don't understand what all these things really mean. These are just... But if you're worried about the technical problem of locating, okay, you've got a wonderful... Over there, the phone book is, you know, it's like no mistakes over there. And, you know, the... You follow? You don't have to worry about that. Yeah.
Okay, one person good to share with another person. I'll show you what I mean. For example, it says in the Torah that the father should not be put to death with the son, the son should not be put to death with the father.
Yeah.
Now, if a son commits a wrong, for example, steals,
yeah,
and is younger than Mamitsa, can a father be to shoot for that son in order to correct it or not?
No, there's a lot of things. Did you hear the question? The question was, can one person do tshuva for another? If somebody did something wrong, can another person correct it? And the example you was given, a child under bar mitzvah does something wrong, can the father correct it or expiate? There are a lot of different questions you asked, but basically the answer is this. A child under bar mitzvah, no one has to do tshuva for that action, because the child isn't responsible for his actions at that level yet. The amazing thing about children under bar mitzvah is that since they don't have mature intellect halachically, again, they're bound by negative mitzvahs. They're not allowed to steal, etc. But they're not actionable. It's not actionable against them, the things that they did. Okay? That's not the thing. However, children have a remarkable paradox, because I'm just mentioning this in passing. Although they're not accountable for their actions, you are accountable for your actions to them, worse than to adults. If you say something negative about a child, it's much worse than about an adult, because the child isn't old enough to forgive you. Lashon hara against the child. Okay? Or hurting a child's feelings, just to understand this. There are stories of Gedolei Yisrael. I know stories. I know of people. Great men. Right? The spiritual leaders of their generation. Who made it their business. Unbelievable. I'm told this happened to Rav Moshe Feinstein also. Made it his business to be present at a child's bar mitzvah. Why? So that right after bar mitzvah, he could go up to him and ask him to forgive him. For once, shifting him aside in his seat in shul when he was six. You follow? Because in case that child will still be hurt by that, the child forgotten it long ago. But he hadn't forgotten. You follow? Because an adult you can go up to and you can clear it up. But a child can't meaningfully give, a child can accept, but he can't give you. He doesn't have the halachic contractual ability to be able to do that. So that's children, another thing. But your broader question was, can one person atone or fix up for another? The general answer is the person can't. There are some mystical exceptions such that, and this is a very, very dangerous subject, I'll tell you only on condition that you promise to forget it right away. Because the Christians have, this has been misapplied in Christianity in a horrible way. And that is, there is a mystical pathway where the suffering of one individual can prevent certain damage happening to another individual. It says in certain mystical sources that the Mashiach ben Yosef, one of the forms of the Mashiach, is actually suffering for us right now. It says in Gemara that there were great Tanoim who took on many years as a Rebbe, it says, suffered for 13 years, tremendous physical pain, and in the merit of his suffering it never rained. It never rained for 13 years and it never had to. And no one died before their time in that generation. That means his suffering, just suffering, was intense enough to have an effect, to absorb certain what's called in him, certain negative things. That's a very, very mystical pathway. That's not, but it's not what's been translated in Christological thinking, that the Mashiach can atone for you. It doesn't mean that somebody can do wrong and just throw the burden onto the founder of, whatever it is, and he will take care of it for you. It doesn't work that way, unfortunately, you know. But there is a dimension of truth in that, just as in every detail of Christianity is a very deep mystical, Kabbalistic truth. There is that. Okay, what I'd like to do with your permission is this. We'd like to say Tehillim, okay, for the situation. You know that the situation in Israel is not exactly settled down. People's lives are in danger all the time.